Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. If you could spare your family years of humiliation at the expense of your daughter's identity, would you do it? The traditional preference for sons in Afghan society makes parents who produce only girls the objects of pity. And the different status levels afforded to men and women in Afghanistan begins in childhood, when boys are allowed to roam free and girls are expected to venture out only in the company of a male chaperone. So, as journalist Jenny Nordberg discovered, sometimes Afghan parents create a son artificially, if only temporarily, by disguising a prepubescent daughter as a boy to enjoy all the special privileges of maleness until her body betrays her and she is forced to live once again as a female in preparation for marriage and motherhood. Jenny Nordberg shares some of these stories in her new book, The Underground Girls of Kabul, In Search of a Hidden Resistance in Afghanistan. Jenny, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
So, fascinatingly, you first learned about this from two little twin sisters in Afghanistan who very matter-of-factly told you, our little brother is really our little sister.
Yes, that's true. I was in Kabul to do an entirely different story on women there. And I happened to be chatting with these two very cute, very girly 10-year-olds who spoke a little bit of English while their mother, whom I was interviewing later on, was in the other room. And then one of them just said, you know, our brother is really a girl. And they were speaking of their youngest brother in the family. And I said, okay. And then the other twin said, no, really, it's our sister, to really make the point, to make sure that I wasn't missing their great reveal.
Hmm. And not surprisingly, you didn't believe them at first.
No, I thought we might have a language issue, but I also did have this underlying feeling that I may have had entirely missed something in my homework on Afghanistan, because many things are strange in Kabul, and this might be just something that they did, I thought to myself fleetingly in that moment. I had seen a picture of their youngest brother, and it was a 6-year-old child looking very much like a boy, similar to his sisters, but with a short haircut and a little denim shirt and a big grin on his face. So to me, it was entirely a boy.
So how did you broach the subject with their mother, Azita?
Oh, I didn't. I was I conducted an entirely formal and professional interview with her about the situation for women in Afghanistan. And I was afraid to bring it up because I couldn't just phrase the question even, you know, might your son really be a girl? And if so, why? So I didn't say anything. And I think she might have made up her mind, though, to tell me, because at one point she just came out and said, I have 4 daughters. And I looked at her quietly, hoping that she would continue. And she said, we dress our youngest like a boy. And again, I tried as a journalist not to show emotion. And I said, why is that? And that's how we began talking about it.
So Azita, this mother, is really the heart of this story in many ways. She's a highly educated woman and a member of the Afghan parliament when we're first introduced to her in this book. But she was married off to an illiterate farmer who by birthright is sort of head of household, even though he does nothing to support it.
Yes. She grew up under the communist era in Kabul, and she was singled out as a particularly talented child and went to an elite school there. And she had a great future ahead of her in her own mind and in that of her parents. She spoke 5 languages fluently. But then the Mujahideen came. There was civil war. The family had to flee. And things changed. She had to kill all her dreams, as she put it to me. And as society closed, as it does in war, things become more difficult for women. And her father feared that she might be kidnapped or taken by one of the warlords. And he made the decision also to strengthen the family by, you know, making a liaison with another family to marry her off against her will. And this is the privilege of an Afghan father. And she really couldn't say much about this. And instead of then taking a role, as she had presumed, to become a doctor or a leader in society, she was to become the wife of an illiterate farmer in one of the most far-flung provinces of Afghanistan. And this was under the Taliban.
Hmm. So she has so much going for her, Azita does, and yet she was treated really with disdain or with pity because she hadn't yet given birth to a girl. Here she is in Parliament, and the first thing people want to ask her is why she's not home trying to have a son.
Yes. I mean, and once she had managed to come out from the situation in the province and return to Kabul somewhat triumphantly as an elected member of parliament, she was excited and eager to try and help change Afghanistan as one of the very few women in parliament there. And she found that she was questioned. She was constantly questioned, even by her constituents, who said, how can we trust you? How can we see that you can accomplish anything at all when you can't even give your husband a son? And her husband was also humiliated by this, as a father and a man in Afghanistan who has only daughters. He's seen as a weak man, someone who is even made a mockery of by others. So it was a problem for the whole family.
Has anyone in Afghanistan made an effort to explain to both women and men the biological mechanisms by which sex is selected in babies?
Yes, there have been several aid projects in attempting to educate people about this. It is the firm belief of many Afghans, and you have to also consider that it's a largely illiterate country, that the mother, the woman, can in fact affect the sex of her unborn child, which is not true. It actually comes from the father. But very few Afghans are aware of that. So even women who can't give birth to sons and will have a constant, you know, a daughter and then another daughter and then a daughter again, she oftentimes will blame her own body for not cooperating, because it is in the interest of both men and women there to have a son, or several sons ideally, since it's such a deeply patriarchal society. Sons are what counts.
So one of the things that people do superstitiously to perhaps cause the next child they give birth to be a son is take their youngest daughter and dress her as a boy.
Yes, this is one of the reasons why you'd turn a daughter into a son. I mean, there are practical reasons, there are reasons of survival sometimes, but there's also this superstitious, if you want to call it that, reason, where you could almost see it as a version of what we call manifestation. If you see something in front of you every day, if you see something that looks like a son in a shirt and pants and a short haircut who behaves like a son, that will then physically affect the woman's body. This is old folklore that's existed for a long time. Many doctors also believe this. And it's one of the reasons, and it's quite prevalent, for making up this kind of third gender in a family.
So tell us how Azita and her husband made the decision to take their youngest daughter, Manoush, and turn her into Mehran.
It was a very practical event, and she explained it in a very matter-of-fact way to me. They both went to Mehran, who was 5 at the time, and they made her an offer. They said to her, would you like to play outside? Would you like to ride a bike? Would you like to play cricket? Would you like to be with the boys and be one of the boys? And Manoush at the time said, yes, that sounds like a great idea. And the next day she was taken to the barber and her hair was cut off. So, and then her name was tweaked into Mehran as a more boyish sounding name. And that was that. She was introduced as the family's son to newcomers, and she arrived back at school, which had been, you know, closed for a change of semesters. Going into the next semester, she entered as a boy.
And within the family, this is really fascinating. She seems a little bit spoiled, like the other girls are having to eat, you know, a roll or an egg for breakfast or whatever has been cooked for them. And Mehran gets to say, no, I want cookies. And I don't know if you felt like that was because she's acting as the son and therefore has this extra status, or just because maybe she's the baby in the family.
I don't know, but I think it's very what you're saying is exactly right. And I spoke to Azita about this, and I also spoke to Mehran's father. It is their youngest, and it's someone that they shower with extra love. But it's also that Mehran is learning to that she has these privileges. She will come first. Those with pants always come first in Afghan society. So she will behave in a different way, and she will be more entitled. And her teachers in school also told me about this, that she will see herself as someone who will, you know, play and be display a more wild behavior, which is typically then in a very traditional society considered to be more boyish. And she's different that way from her sisters. And she does have a little bit of attitude and spunk, and maybe that's who she is and who she always was. But maybe that's also something that her sisters would have developed. We don't really know.
And this all comes with an expiration date.
It does. In Afghan society, regardless of what you do with your children and how you present them to the outside world and of which gender, the traditional path of an Afghan woman is to get married and have children of her own, and those should ideally be sons. And that also comes with some very specific criteria, which is that you should remain very pure before marriage. So as soon as you come of age, as soon as you enter puberty, as a young woman in Afghanistan, you are to be sheltered and kept indoors mostly. The responsibility of this falls on the father in the family. So then it's the curtain goes down for this type of experiment in most cases, where a little girl will be given a headscarf and a skirt and expected to fall into the role of a very demure and shy and withdrawn Afghan young girl, so that she will so that it's possible to present her as excellent marriage material to someone of her parents' choice.
One of the things that Manoush Azmehran was able to provide for her family was that she had the freedom to go out in public, and then she could act as their chaperone out in public. So her sisters actually had a bit more freedom because she was part of the family.
It is a practical solution in that sense for the whole family. For Azita's family, it was the prestige and the honor of the family, and that it helped her as a parliamentarian and the whole surface presentation of the family, but also that it afforded more freedom of movement for the entire family. Mehran can run errands. She can escort her sisters. They all get to see more of the outside world, essentially. And there's also a little bit of subversion involved in this because, as Azita said to me, I wanted to show my youngest what life is like on the other side. So Mehran does get a whole different experience of childhood in Kabul compared to her sisters.
Of course, for some families, the shift is less optional than it was maybe for Mehran, because there are families that need a child to work and girls are not allowed to work outside the home.
No, I mean, that would be sneered upon even if the parents themselves would allow it. Society is not constructed in a way that you see many girls and women in public life. And those are the reasons for why you would do this that would fall into pure survival. There are the street children, for instance, who will sell things or beg even. Those are all boys. And there are girls in those groups of boys as well, dressed as little boys. I've interviewed one family of eight, a Pashtun family, where the husband is not providing for the family, and the mother can't really work or go outside even. So they're sending out their little daughter to work in a store, and there are many cases like that. And there's certainly no element of freedom or subversion even in that. It's a very practical solution that often break these children down in hard labor, frankly.
We're speaking this hour with journalist Jenny Nordberg. Her new book is called The Underground Girls of Kabul, In Search of a Hidden Resistance in Afghanistan. You can be part of the conversation now by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering a new certificate program in project management November 3rd through 7th on the SMU campus. Information at smu.edu/project management.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with journalist Jenny Nordberg about her new book, The Underground Girls of Kabul, In Search of a Hidden Resistance in Afghanistan. You can join our conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or by emailing think@kera.org. Jenny, what happened when you started asking scholars and social science experts about this phenomenon?
Well, I did what we journalists do many times. I turned to the experts to find out what this was all about. And I was thoroughly dismissed by them. They told me that Afghanistan is a very segregated society, one of the most segregated, gender-segregated places on earth. And for children to switch to just, you know, become the other gender would be unthinkable and even dangerous. So I better not pursue this line of investigation. And surely there was no such thing and there were no such children. And had there been any, there would have been books written about it. And certainly they would have known about this, not only because we have been there now for the past decade with some of our best writers and journalists and historians and anthropologists and diplomats and the military.
But if you ask around through the grapevine, you can start to find stories, and in fact you did, of other girls doing this.
Yes. I mean, I'm embarrassed to say, of course, that I asked the foreign experts on Afghanistan, and very shortly after that, I began to ask every single Afghan who said, of course, yes, they're called bachapush. It means dressed up like a boy. And it's almost like a third gender there. You have a daughter or a son or a bachapush. Everyone will know about it. And almost every Afghan I spoke to would offer someone up. They'd say, oh, it's, you know, my cousin did that or my great-grandmother. There's someone in my children's school. And I used to know someone when I went to school. Doctors will often know about it because children are brought in, little boys are brought in and then turn out to be girls, in fact. And teachers will be aware that there's usually one or two in a school who present as a boy, but who's in fact a little girl.
How concerned are members of Afghan society about the psychological effect this might have on a little girl?
Well, I've spoken to many of the mothers about this, and Azita in particular, I challenged on this several times. And I said, you know, what's going to happen to Mehran? What if this will be difficult for her? And Azita told me very sincerely, I think about that every day. Mm-hmm. I think about this all the time and I worry. And but I think you have to put it in the larger context of what Afghanistan is and what it's like there. It's considered to be the world's most dangerous place to be born a girl, and also the worst place, according to the United Nations. So given that, you know, and the fact that it's a country that's been at war for decades, when you speak of psychological consequences of growing up in a war and being constantly traumatized, Azita's children, you know, they've been in bomb blasts or too close to bomb blasts, and they've seen shootings, and they live in this constant state of insecurity. So yes, certainly this is something that parents do to their children there, but maybe it's also something that they do for their children sometimes, because it does afford a little bit of an opportunity many times, even to an education. If you live in a difficult area and the road to school is hard to get through for a little girl, for instance. So it's a complicated question where there, you know, it contains elements of tragedy as well as subversion and resistance.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Julius in Arlington. Hi, Julius.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm sorry, this breaks my heart. I'm a man with four sisters, and so to me, it's just, as you say, it's another world. I was wondering, from a standpoint of the powers that be, it almost seems like there have to be someone who is either at an economic, religious, some type of, it just seems like someone must be benefiting from keeping our society that way. I'm wondering if there's, who is it that you think probably benefits from the society remaining that way? And if things are going to change, who do you think it would benefit the most, of course, besides the women?
Thanks for your call.
Thank you. That's a wonderful question. And I think that goes to the very core of why I first came to Afghanistan. I wanted to find out why it is that women are so suppressed there, and why are girls and women counted as nothing? What's really at the core of that? And I think, you know, my 5 years back and forth, it's a story of oppression in the sense that those with power, in this case, men and very wealthy and connected and politically savvy men, are very unwilling to give up power, financial power, political power, any kind of power, sexual power. So those who hold the power of life, in what I mean by that is deciding when women can, you know, are getting pregnant and give birth to new members of society, those really hold all the powers. So once you turn that over to women, and they can decide for themselves, you can't really control all of society. I mean, essentially, you shut off out half of society from any political decision or you know, ability to control themselves and their own bodies. So, you know, of course, those on the other side, meaning, again, the men here and the very powerful men, are unwilling to give up any of that. And they'll use excuses like religion or culture or society or tradition. You'll hear all of that. But what it comes down to in the end is money and power. And if you know, and we've seen that in our own history as well. Why would you want to share that if you can have 100%? Why would you want to give away half of it?
I was really fascinated by what you included in the book about Dr. Fareba. Can you tell us a little bit about her?
Yes. This is an Afghan female Afghan doctor who has worked for decades as a midwife and a doctor and helped, you know, hundreds of children, according to herself. And she also freelances on the side as a son maker, where she will give advice to Afghan parents on how to conceive sons. She will offer potions, sexual positions, powders, homemade powders, advice on what to eat. There's this whole ancient knowledge and that is very, very widespread. And there's also some superstition in this where you use natural remedies in order to produce a son. And some of that we've seen in our society, too. And, you know, you'll find it online here with parents who want to get a certain gender of their child. So this is what she does. And she charges a little extra for this. And she's a very well-respected Afghan doctor.
Does she believe it? Does she
believe
she can make
sense? She would challenge me. I mean, the only way to determine the sex of an unborn child or you know, before conception is essentially to do this manually, technically. You know, you'd separate the sperm and you'd insert a fertilized egg with the right, you know, sex into a woman's womb. But there's all kinds of suspicion around, you know, how to get boys, how to get girls. And it's existed for centuries. And what we call maybe new age in our society is old age over there. And when you're desperate enough to have sons and when girls are so dismissed and despised many times, and it's such a burden for families to have more girls, you'll take extraordinary measures, such as consulting Dr. Fareba, for instance, and there are many of her.
You have scenes from the maternity ward that she works in, and women who've had boys are feted with gifts, and they're brought food and pounds of butter. Sometimes if they've given birth to a girl, they'll be denied food for a matter of days.
Yes, it's a punishment. The woman who will give birth to a girl often returns to her village with her head bowed in shame. She's brought bad luck over her family. And you also, I think it's important to again put this in context that this is very practical. You know, it's not an extreme hatred of women. It's not fundamentalism. When society is arranged in a way, and this goes back to the caller's question, when society is arranged in a way that all privileges are given to men, you know, sons will inherit. They will carry on the family name. They're the only one who can, you know, be passed where they will get the property lineage, for instance, and they can work outside and they will defend the family. What do you do if you don't have any sons? It makes life virtually impossible for these families with only daughters. And again, it comes down to money. It comes down to being able to support yourself and to get a job or to get a loan. I mean, there's only a semblance of a government and it doesn't reach all over throughout the country. And there's no 401k, there's no social social security, this very deeply patriarchal system, which we also see, you know, in our societies and certainly in our own history, it's the culture of the gun and of force. And in that, men and sons are extremely important.
Jenny, are women in Afghanistan aware that it's not like that everywhere in the world?
Yes. This is why they, many times when I came to interview them, they started out by interviewing me first. Mm-hmm. There were many things that they wanted to find out from me, and sometimes greatly misinformed and sometimes with a very, or most times, very good idea of the freedoms that I have that they don't have. That's something that we, you know, can't teach them anything about because they're very well aware of what their lives are like compared to women in other countries, that they can't move and they can't go out and all those sorts of things. And they were curious about, you know, why you can go anywhere you want, but you choose to come to Afghanistan. Why is that? You know, how can your father allow you to travel? Have you had sex with 1,000 men? Why are you not married? Why don't you have any children? Hmm. Are you miserable? Is your life a failure?
I mean, where do you start answering
very
those
kind,
questions?
Right. Very, very lovely, kind-hearted questions and very sincere questions. Mm-hmm. And I try to answer them all.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go now to Ralph in Durant, Oklahoma. Hi, Ralph.
Hey, how are you guys doing?
Very well, thank you.
I just wanted to know, the lady you were speaking of that was going to be in Parliament, you said the daughter is treated as a boy, dressed like a boy and everything. I just wanted to know, whenever they, when they grow up and they emerge from that, and, you know, they have a good idea of what life is and what it is for girls and things like that of that nature, does the family still live in shame even if they don't have a boy at that time? Or does that girl take that position that almost, in my opinion, it's like a scapegoat? I just want to know if they can ever come back from that. Do they ever get their name back from that? Do they always have to live in disgrace knowing that, or do they just keep trying and trying and roll with it?
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, thank you for that question. Well, it's a complicated transition for the girls and the children especially. I describe this practice almost as a don't ask, don't tell in Afghan society. Everyone's aware of it. They know what's going on. They may not do it to their own child, but it's perfectly acceptable. And you won't really get into each other's business in that way and you know, criticize another family's choice. As long as the girls are turned back before puberty, they're fine. They'll in terms of, you know, the how society views them. There's no shame in that. However, if these girls, and some of them do, if they push it further than that, and if they manage to resist their parents, and most don't, and live a few years as a, you know, young man, essentially, then it becomes very controversial and even dangerous, because you're not supposed to reach for privileges that you're not supposed to have in Afghan society at that time. So women driving, for instance, or, you know, young women dressed as boys who are found out playing sports or hanging out with other boys, that will fall back on the father as his failure to protect and shelter his young women. So that can become very complicated and very dangerous for these girls.
You have one young woman profiled in the book who chose this for herself, has older brothers, but really decided she wanted to live as a boy. And I don't know if this is about society and what it says, or if this is about her personal gender identity, but can you tell us a little bit about her?
Yes, I think you're talking about Nahed. Mm-hmm. And she was Nadia before. And she was brought up as a young boy, and her father died, and she managed to convince her brothers, who are the ones who take over custody of her life then, that she should remain a young man to help the family and to support the mother. And through that, she's managed to remain in disguise as a young man into adult age. And she now works, she plays sports, she trains other, you know, young Bachapush girls and tries to encourage them. the way she describes it to me is that the male has stuck with her. It's all that she's ever known. She didn't want to go back, and she's fought very hard for this, and she's made her physical appearance into that of a man's, and it's very credible. You know, she has a flat chest. She has a hunched way of walking. She's hunched over. She has short hair. She wears a sports coat. She walks in an exaggerated fashion with her hips forward. And this is her identity. And if you are to believe any of the many theories of how gender is formed in a person, it is that when you birth sex is a reality, and then gender is something that you develop. Mm-hmm. So it's a combination of the two. And she's been a boy and a man for so long that it's the only thing she knows. It would be very foreign for her to be traditionally female and to sit with women and to cheek kiss and to drink tea and to giggle and to gossip. She knows none of that, and she's not interested in that.
What do they do in the home of a Bachaposh about pronouns?
Well, it's actually it's more simple in Dari, which is one of the Persian dialects spoken in Afghanistan, because it's many times you refer to it not as his or hers, but it. Mm-hmm. So it's helpful in that way, and it becomes more confusing when you translate it into English, in fact. So, but they will call a bachaposh it many times, or a he when it's appropriate. It's someone who will be seen entirely as a son in the family. And Nazita said this to me, and her husband too. She would laugh and said, yes, you know, I think of her as my son now. That's what she is to me.
My guest is journalist Jenny Nordberg. We're talking about her new book, The Underground Girls of Kabul, In Search of a Hidden Resistance in Afghanistan. We'll take more of your calls and questions after the break. If you would like to join us, you can get on the line at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering a new certificate program in project management November 3rd through 7th on the SMU campus. Information at smu.edu/project-management.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with journalist Jenny Nordberg about her new book, The Underground Girls of Kabul, In Search of a Hidden Resistance in Afghanistan. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. And that's where we have an interesting question from Beth in Fort Worth, who wants to know, how can a disguised girl be a chaperone to sisters when neighbors and relatives know the truth?
Yes, that is a good question. Again, it goes back to the don't ask, don't tell. Some neighbors might be aware of this. They won't really know for sure. Some will know that this is, in fact, a girl. But it's such a dysfunctional society in that it's so segregated. So it's almost that it's better to at least have the girl look like a boy, and then it's okay. The point isn't really to deceive anyone. It's more to disappear into a crowd. It's a form of a cloak almost because when you've segregated society in such an extreme way that girls are supposed to look a certain way and do certain things and, you know, not have any rights almost at all, and boys are on the other side, it's almost as though you play along more and you go along with society more if you dress up a girl like a boy and then she takes her sisters out. So it's not a provocation even to Afghans in that way. It's more that you'll concede to society that way.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Jack on the line in Denton. Hi, Jack.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Thank you for taking the call. I was just wanting the guest comment on the situation of a comparison. We look with criticism and disdain on the way that the females are treated in Afghanistan, and yet here in America, we have fundamentalist bodies that keep females down. They offer no roles of leadership. And why can't our society see the detriment and the long-range bad results that we're doing here in America?
Jenny, do you think that's a fair comparison?
Well, I mean, I would love for anyone who reads my book to begin to think about how we discriminate when it comes to race and gender and religion and ethnicity and sexuality, sexual orientation. I would love for anyone to start thinking about those things, because that's what this whole journey has made me think about. I mean, as the previous caller asked too, you know, why is this? Why is this going on? I mean, we have this in our own history. This is what women have always done when, you know, one side of the population has been excluded so entirely. Women couldn't get an education. They couldn't become doctors. They couldn't, you know, enlist to become soldiers. And there were always those who tried to sneak over to the other side by disguising themselves. And it's a symptom of an impossible system and something that's so dysfunctional. And yes, I think there are fair comparisons to, you know, to slavery, to racism, to apartheid. And it should make us think about why it's so important for those in power to control women, to control women's bodies, to control the birth of new children and new citizens, and why that is. You know, why it's so important for them to hold on to that. As soon as you start educating women and give them some power over their own bodies, well, I'm sorry, you're not going to have all the power and all the money to yourself anymore on the male side. And again, you know, there are men who promote this development, and especially in Afghanistan. I've met many fathers who completely disagree with this system and do many things, including disguising their daughters in order for them to get an education and to do anything they want in life. But they're living in a very difficult society, and that's very slow and changing.
So is it as risky for an enlightened man to speak up as for a woman to speak up for her own rights?
Oh, absolutely. Maybe even more sometimes in Afghanistan, because society will come down very hard on those who promote women. And this is, it, again, if we look at our own history and the struggles of women, it didn't really, you know, go anywhere until all, you know, people from all sides of the population and men too, and you can also make comparisons to the civil rights movement, came in and said, this is wrong. This isn't working for me. I'm suffering under this system too. We have to change this. So there are those forces in Afghanistan, but it is it's difficult for them. It's difficult for a progressive Afghan father to stand up to his neighbors and to his employers and to his family and say, I'm going to educate my girl because that's the right thing to do. And they will question him, and they will, you know, others will invoke, again, religion and tradition and say that it's shameful. And so those are agents of change. And many times those are the men and the fathers of these girls.
What happens to bachaposhas who, for whatever reason, can't carry off the disguise for long, cannot pass?
Well, some of them don't want to, and they protest, and they will then be turned back into girls again. Most often, though, before puberty. But I've focused mainly in my research on those who resist. But there are certainly those girls who just, you know, their voices will be too high early on. They will be too, you know, display a very girly and giggly demeanor, and they don't want to go along with what their parents have decided for them, and they're uncomfortable with that.
Will you tell us a little bit about what it was like for you and what it is like for you to travel through Afghanistan? Because as a non-Muslim foreign woman, you're almost treated like you're a third sex.
Oh, yes. I'm a third gender. I'm a neuter. I'm a foreign entity. What's good about being a woman as a correspondent in conservative and gender-segregated societies is that you'll have access to both sides of the population. You can speak to women. You can come into women's close quarters many times, which a male journalist couldn't do, or couldn't do easily at least. And then the men will treat you very respectfully and not place the same demands and expectations of you as a foreign woman, and speak to you as a man. So it's a very beneficial situation to be a woman and working in Afghanistan, for instance, in that way.
How do you manage your own emotions when I can read in this book that you empathize with so many of the people that you interview who are in such dire straits and have very little hope of getting beyond them?
Well, the classic trait of journalism is that you should show no emotion and you should make no friends. But you certainly shouldn't share anything about yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in this research, and I'm an investigative journalist, I've had to modify some of those things. I mean, it's been very clear who's the subject and who's the interviewer. But like I said before, I've had to open up, and I can't, you know, I realize I couldn't walk into people's homes and ask them to open up about their deepest, darkest secrets that they've never told anyone about before. I mean, most of these women have never told anyone about their experience of growing up as a boy. I had to stay, and I had to have tea, and I had to tell them about myself and why I was there, and did they want to do this? And many times I'm angry and I'm upset, you know, not visibly and not with them, but the hardest thing of all is to leave. It's when you back out and you say, well, thank you for telling me your life story. I'm now going to get on a plane and I'm going to go to New York, and then I'm going to walk out of my house and I'm going to go and get delicious food to eat and do anything I want. That's my privilege, and that's my world where I rule. And that, I think, for any foreign correspondent might be the hardest thing of all, because it stays with you. And I've stayed in touch with these women and for the past 5 years now. I spoke to Azita the other day. She was ducking because from her window they were shooting outside. And we do speak quite often. And that is, it's a very complicated, those are very complicated emotions involved, because it is unfair and it's infuriating in that they're there and I'm here.
Is there any doubt in Azita's mind that things would be better for her and for her daughters if the Soviets had stayed?
Oh, this is an interesting thing that Afghans in Kabul tend to talk about a lot. It's a little superficial sometimes, because, you know, Afghans will say, well, at least the Russians, you know, built some infrastructure. And I'm sure they will say the same thing about Americans and Europeans. I think it's different because there's a very sharp divide between the urban areas and the more rural countryside in Afghanistan. Many times in the urban areas is where, you know, development happens. Those were the ones who many times collaborated with the Russians, who were, you know, communist sympathizers. Whereas out around in the country, there was brutal war, there was slaughter, and they fought the Russians. I mean, in Kabul, where Azita grew up under the Russians, she had a fairly charmed existence there, and there was peace until the Mujahideen arrived and there was civil war. So they have a somewhat more rosy-eyed view of the Russians there. And Azita also, her family and her father specifically, was sympathizing with the communists at the time, and which gave her great opportunities for an education. And he was a university professor. Many of the intellectuals in Kabul and in other urban areas had those, those sympathies, and it was part of life there. And many of the former communist sympathizers and even, you know, communist leaders are now again have risen to prominence in the political sphere and in power brokers in Afghanistan. So they're a recognized part of society there, although there's no love, I would say, for Russians or communism per se. I mean, that's something that's dismissed as infidels usually.
Let's go to the phones now and speak with Jerry in Fort Worth. Hi, Jerry. Jerry, are you with us? Okay, we don't have Jerry. Birth control is readily available in Afghanistan. Is it essentially only used by people who already have a son?
Yes, it's perfectly fine to use birth control. There's no stigma about that. Many times, the reason why you wouldn't have access to birth control is a practical one, because you live far away and you couldn't get to a doctor or you couldn't get to a pharmacy and you simply wouldn't have access to it. For the woman who has no children or only daughters, birth control isn't really an option. This goes straight into the population question as well. Why would someone give birth to 6, 8, 10 children? Well, if you have a few sons, it's perfectly fine to have 3 or 4 children in Afghanistan. If you give birth to one daughter after another, there are women who have 9, 10 daughters because they constantly keep trying for a son.
Hmm. Tell us a little bit about the process of turning back into a girl around the time that a girl's expected to hit puberty, what that looks like, and how does it happen gradually or does it happen overnight?
Many times it happens overnight. There could be a party where the womanhood is introduced and the relatives are invited in. Usually it happens right around the time of the first menstruation, ideally before, and the girl will be presented with a dress, encouraged to grow her hair out, you know, introduced to more womanly things. She will learn to cook. She will be taught to walk differently and talk differently. Again, in the extreme segregation, the gender roles are exaggerated, and that's also ironically what makes it easier to pass over to the other side. But they, you know, many times they would look at me and say, you speak like a man and you walk like a man and, you know, you would put your hands on your hips and that's very masculine. You can't do that. So in that, the young girl who's been brought up in a very male fashion and taught to do all the male things and display the male traits, she will then be re-educated in a more feminine fashion.
What kinds of choices, if any, will Azita's daughters, her 4 daughters, have when they are of marriageable age?
Well, that depends very much on what's going to happen in Afghanistan right now. There's just a new president, and there's a peaceful transition has taken place, which is extremely encouraging. There is still a sense of insecurity, and with all the foreigners pulling out, the military, the diplomats, the foreign aid, much of it is leaving. So I think it depends on what the next decade will bring. Azita, of course, is hoping for an education, maybe for even studies abroad for her children. I mean, this is what her entire life is about, to not have them be taken back to the province and married off as child brides. And she is in a very complicated marriage where her husband is more conservative and also more from another area and of another mind. So it depends on that, and it depends on the security situation overall, because if Afghanistan falls into more of a civil war, say, for instance, again, the argument will be easier to make, to take them out of school, to marry them off, to close their worlds entirely.
The new book by journalist Jenny Nordberg is called The Underground Girls of Kabul, In Search of a Hidden Resistance in Afghanistan. Jenny, a fascinating story. Thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Thank you so much.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered today by Eric Bright. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think and email the show at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.